Okay. It's all you.
Totally agree, Robin.
Yeah, it's not an easy edit.
I feel like we've made your job really hard today, Dan. I'm really sorry.
Rabbiting on. Rabbiting on.
Hello. I think we are all still buzzing for being back for our fifth series of Rabbiting On. That doesn't feel real yet. And I shared during the last episode, which we did on body image and appearance, that I found our conversation so moving. And then listening back, I was moved again. I think it was a really important conversation. So I'm just interested, how are you two doing, first of all? And have you had any conversations, or how have you found the first episode being out there in the world?
I've had some really interesting conversations. It's led to kind of, you know, the next episode almost, in terms of, like, I feel the conversations carried on beyond here. Also just how other people hear it. So I had a lovely conversation with a young adult in the community who has got various disabilities and was talking about, actually for her, weight loss and all those conversations are actually around maintaining her strength, which is about keeping her independence so that she can, you know, keep moving and keep being able to have as much independence as possible. And I think we fixate on, like, looks, and then we move to health, but actually that's also a great way of being able to understand the topic a bit more as well.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. It's one of the first episodes I have listened a bit back to. I only listened to half of it. kind of wondering how the edit went and what it sounded like. And I know Miriam and I find it really hard to listen to our own voices.
I've never listened to an episode of Rabbiting On.
I know.
I can't believe that.
But yeah, I also found it really emotional making that episode. And then the conversations that have come from it have just been really lovely to have, because it's one of those things that I think a lot of us sit with and are a bit uncomfortable voicing, articulating, because it's an uncomfortable conversation, because society has told us it is to some extent, and that we have to have a particular way of understanding these things. And just people feeling very affirmed and particularly loving, like, the blessings, I think, that Robin, you brought into the language of how we talk about it.
Yeah, because I received a gorgeous message on Instagram, and that message kind of added another blessing on top of the blessings that we sort of ended with. And she wrote, when the time comes, because we spoke about, you know, being at the end and still being concerned about body image. She said, when the end comes, may we all be on deathbeds reminiscing about the impact we made on this world rather than the little space we took up. Amen to that. It was beautiful to receive that. And actually, segueing into our topic today, which is all about politics, which is related. The body. We spoke a bit about how politics plays into the body last time. We're going to talk today about how political are we? Should we be? What's the role of politics in community, etc., etc. I recently came across a quotation, which I'd not read before, by a Holocaust survivor, Elie Wiesel, which is apt because we've just marked Holocaust Memorial Day. And he wrote, we must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages a tormentor, never the tormented. And actually, I have heard that before. It's something maybe that we use quite a lot. But I'm kind of wondering, the times that we're in with the Middle East, the conversation about migration, the flags that are flying all around Manchester, maybe this hits differently than it has previously. Maybe it feels harder. Maybe it feels more real as a question to us of, what does it mean to be neutral? What does it mean to take a side? What does it mean to be silent? Whose side are we on? All of those questions. I think that quote really sums up for me a lot about the times we're in and some of the questions I've got about my actions. So I'd be really interested in your thoughts about the Elie Wiesel quote.
Yeah, it does feel like it hits differently. And I suppose I'm bound up with this stuff that we've talked about previously when it comes to particularly Israel and Palestine in the Middle East, and that sense of always hearing another voice throwing into the debate in my head. Someone says one thing and I can hear another thing being thrown in, and the constant sort of back and forth. And actually, the act of side taking and what that means in today's politics, I think is really interesting. We actually do need to hear the suffering of both sides. And I think the attempt to oversimplify these long protracted conflicts has made it worse.
I think there's also that moving plate of what conversations are acceptable to have. I was fascinated. So we're recording this on a day that Keir Starmer's in China. And on the news this morning, they were talking about the fact that, you know, there's obviously a debate and a discussion about whether he should be there and having these conversations at all. But they said that he will definitely feel that he has to ask about and challenge on human rights violations, because if he doesn't, the Chinese will see it as a sign of weakness that he didn't feel able to bring it to the table and to kind of to flag it, which is fascinating in itself, right? That sense of not I should be ashamed of the way that we behave or how we act, but if you can't even see that we do things outside of your value system and you're not prepared to call us on it, we don't even see you as a equal party in the conversation. And actually, how often is part of our lack of challenge about that fear of being in a place of disagreement? Whereas actually, what does it show in terms of when you gain respect for holding another view? And maybe we need to hold on to that a little bit as well.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's like a kind of double, triple bluff almost, isn't it? I think I'm very aware that I hate the language of sides, of them and us, and being put into kind of camps and labels on, you know, what I am and who am I aligned to in that way. And I had two really formative experiences, probably just in the last year, of speaking to two people who hold wildly different politics to me, completely different politics in every way that you can imagine, almost. And one of them is someone I absolutely love. They're a friend. They are the kindest person in the world. They do so much for other people. And we were having a drink in the pub and we were saying to each other, but how could you, I don't understand. Like, I really like you. How is it that you think this? How is it that you think that? And we had, I think, probably one of the best conversations of my life, because it broke down my assumptions of what it is for somebody to support reform, for example, because I'm a very pro-migration, used to be an asylum lawyer. I feel really passionate about these things and get terrified by seeing the flags flying literally around the corner from me. And speaking to him, I really understood what it was that he was afraid of, what he felt like he was aligning himself towards, and understood the complexity of it. What that didn't do was take away from what I believe and what my strong opinions are. But I think it did shape how I talk about these things, and that I don't fall into the trap of seeing other people who think differently to me as monsters or idiots. And I think that's the most dangerous thing in these kind of political conversations, where we dehumanize or denigrate people who think differently from us. That's the thing that I get most scared about. And that conversation really will stay with me for the rest of my life, because it was very helpful for me to break down my assumptions, which I'd carried about why someone might be so, aligned with those politics. It was really powerful.
The need to hear each other is really powerful. You've reminded me actually of when I feel I really learned that lesson, which was actually well over 20 years ago now, when I was running a Jewish Christian Muslim young leaders conference. And I arrived early because I was organizing it, and the Egyptian contingent had arrived early too. And so we went out for breakfast or coffee, I can't remember, and we're just chatting away. And I had a lovely conversation with this guy who'd come from Egypt. And afterwards, talking to someone else in the group, discovered that I was the first Jew he had ever met, and was not what he had expected. And B, that he is a member, a paid up member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And had we known those things about each other going into that conversation, we couldn't have had the conversation.
Wow.
But having got to know each other and then discovered those things, it actually helped shift our sense of humanity in each other, and trying to understand where those things come from. And actually, you know, he was leaving the Muslim Brotherhood in a way, but he had been signed up and been part of that world in a way that would have been totally terrifying to me had I known. And I just wouldn't have been able to say anything, I suspect, at that point. But it's also really interesting when we think about our role as leaders, as community figures, and knowing that when we speak into a room, that diversity of opinion is sitting there and that pain is sitting in that diversity of opinion. How do you manage, Robin, when you do come from such a strong background in this work, to then speak into a community where you know there are reform voters? And we know there are members in our communities that are and that might disagree with where we are politically in lots of ways.
Miriam, did you want to come in?
No, I was just thinking, I mean, for me, it sort of answers that, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it plays into what Debbie was saying, which is there's something about people being people that hold a view because of their experience, right? The Elie Wiesel quote would not be nearly as powerful if you didn't know that he was a Shoah survivor and talking from that experience, and therefore talking directly to and about a group of people that potentially didn't take sides, and that resulted in the experience that he and so many other millions had. And I think there's that in our role in community about being able to say, well, what do we know about somebody that means that we can understand their view coming from a particular place? You know, there are a group of members of my synagogue who served in the IDF at different times in their lives. And that experience deeply shapes their view of Israel and what goes on there in a different way from perhaps our young adults who've grown up in a synagogue environment that has offered itself to be critical of Israel from the perspective potentially often of kind of Reform Judaism and marginalized people within within society. So when you've been on such a different journey to get to a position, understanding the journey, knowing who people are and why they hold that opinion, you know, shapes the story in a very different way. And I think, you know, when you speak, Robin, not just as somebody who, you know, was a human rights lawyer and therefore came at it from a professional perspective, but somebody who also opened your home up to have refugees living alongside you, often for months on end, that's a really different perspective because you're humanizing the story. And it's what worries me, I think, a lot about British society, whether it's many, many of our children in Jewish schools and therefore those Jewish kids not being in other schools, but also our Jewish kids not knowing other people, but also just society at large. You know, we talk about the melting pots of our cities, and actually they're not melting pots at all. Everyone's siloed in their own little communities. They just happen to not have boundaries around where the Iranian community finishes and the Polish community starts and the Jewish community, wedged between the two.
Yeah. And I think that's where communities can be the most powerful force for good at their best, because they can be spaces that can bridge difference, you know, to make connections locally with different communities. And Finchley Reform is a great example of that. You know, the church that's behind it, the mosque that's around the corner, whatever it might be. And I think it's such a good question, Debbie, that you asked about, because it's that perpetual question of like how political should shuls be. And we've all heard stories and probably been told at some point, like, don't be political on the bimmer. You know, it's not for a rabbi to be political. And it's something we talk about at Liebeck College as well in training.
But when we say feed the hungry, are we being political?
Right. Well, for me,
go Robin.
Here we go. I'm getting ready. I'm like, whew, here's my thing. So I think I've got like three main things to say, I reckon. So I'll just say them all at once. Is for me, everything is political. There is nothing that isn't political. The Torah is wildly political in every single way. The prophets were political. Jeremiah spoke about not making alliances with Egypt. You know, it could be that we could sit here and talk about Keir Starmer and China and say, you know, it's not appropriate. Religious leaders have always been political because political is about how we live in this world. So that's one thing I'd say. And the other two things are about how, what it is to talk about these things in community. So the things that I get really wary of is when people talk about the need for unity, that we all need to be unified and working towards a common goal. I think that's true to some extent, but I think what that can do is like wipe out any sense of difference, any diversity, and is a kind of like totalitarian think tank, really, of saying, you know, we're loyal to each other and there isn't room for dissent. And we've seen that play out. But I'm also really wary of the opposite, which is there is this multiplicity of views. So a lot of communities will talk about it's our role to hold community and hold diversity. And again, I think that's true to an extent, but that can't be unmoored or untethered from having underlying values. So I think I've like wrestled with this question since coming into being a student rabbi and a rabbi of how to hold the tension of being able to lead through humanity, to understand where everyone is at, to respect a diversity of opinion and to encourage debate, as producer Dan keeps telling us, like, we're a people who like to debate, like holding that and also being a leader that has, you know, rooted and strong values, who can share that and be respected for having those values, even if people don't agree with them, if they're like textually bound, if they're Jewishly rooted, which mine certainly are. And I actually think, and from that conversation with the guy that I was talking about, I think what he respected was the fact that I had strong views that I'd thought about, that were rooted, that made sense to him. And I understood his as well. And I think I actually am more wary of leaders who don't have the strong values and don't have the integrity to stand by them. But I think it's incredibly hard in community to do this. And I know a lot of colleagues worry about, you know, jobs and the precarity of what it is to put your neck on the line almost to say something, even if you're not saying it in a way that is to alienate, but is to bring people together. It can be misconstrued and people get terrified of what that might be. There you go. That's my little rant.
Not a rant at all. It's really powerful. And I think, you know, we can avoid party politics potentially while still making those value rooted, here's what we can learn from our tradition, from our way of being as a community, from our value systems.
Can I just challenge you really quickly on that? And this is because I'm still wrestling with it. Like, yes, I think politics is different to party politics, but I personally am really worried about reform becoming the government in the UK. I can understand why people follow them. I'm not denigrating that, but I am worried about the future. We know what kind of fascist governments might look like, and what that kind of thinking can do. Is it not on us to lead the charge in communities to talk about that? I don't know. Like, what does it mean if we don't talk about party politics? I don't know the answer. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's a really big question.
So actually, I was really fascinated seeing what was going on and playing out in New York before the mayoral elections, and that some of our colleagues really very vehemently, very passionately spoke out, encouraging their community to not vote for Mamdani, and, you know, suggesting that no Jew could possibly be voting for him. And now he's in power. And actually, I think what's interesting is that adult ability to be able to say, look, this is what democracy is about. This is what voting is about. I took a stance, but now you're in power. And actually, now we need to work together. So you know how passionately I was against you, but now let's sit down and talk and see whether my fears were founded or whether we can have this grown-up conversation. And I think that being given that space to both speak out and to accept kind of the world as it is when it becomes different to how you perhaps may have championed it, I think is an interesting ability to show leadership.
And I've had colleagues who are either from New York or vested in what's happening in New York. I overheard an amazing conversation between a British rabbi and an American rabbi, who the American rabbi was really passionately arguing in favor of Zohran Mamdani's election, and that it was good for the Jews and it was good for New York. And there are plenty of Jews who will have voted for him too. I suppose part of the challenge is politics has become so divisive, right? That black and whiteness of it, which does make that maturity after the matter of coming back together and saying, okay, now we have to work together, that becomes so much harder when the politics is so passionately divided.
And that all our words are timeless now. right? Yeah. So that when you've said something, it's still there. It wasn't just a sermon for the people who were in the room at that moment, but actually you're putting your words out in a kind of forever universe. And we certainly have a society where our politicians are so criticized for any kind of, you know, what's perceived as a U-turn. Nobody's allowed to evolve their thoughts or change their minds. And I think, again, as leaders, being able to reframe that thing of that was then, this is now. I'm fascinated by, you know, if you Google me, the immediate sermons that come up, even things like, you know, I gave a very passionate sermon at the beginning of COVID about not visiting people in hospital and the need to stay away and the need to not accompany people in the way that we might have done. Did I feel like that by the end? No. But actually, our words speak in that moment, and that's okay. I think it's okay to evolve thought and change one's mind. But I don't think we're always given the option to, because I think people judge us by what they once heard or what we once said, especially I think how communities often think, well, I know this rabbi, she's a this voter or a that, you know, that's her politics. And these things do change.
And communally, this stuff has become really of the moment in a way, right? We've just gone through a communal merger of two movements who contain within them wildly diverse approaches to politics and to the Middle East, which were issues for people that did. And interestingly, I was having a conversation this morning with a friend who is a member of a United Synagogue, works for a Reform Synagogue. And when she took the job, was told by friends in the United Synagogue, you cannot go and work for a Reform Synagogue. They all hate Israel. They're all anti-Israel. And I was, you know, she knows this now, but I was sort of saying, actually, of course, that's not true. Just on a basic level, there is a complicated story to tell. But on the other hand, even for those of us who wrestle and who are criticizing Israel, it doesn't necessarily mean we're not loving Israel and not loving the Palestinian people too, right? How do we hold the two? We've done this episode already, but right, how do we hold all that complexity and yet still find ourselves bound together as a community with all that diversity that we're speaking into? And I suppose that goes back for me to how you beautifully framed it, Robin, of let's just keep rooting it in those values and in the text, except we know that the text can speak to multiple things too, and you can justify so many different things from our scriptures.
I think that's why it's so important to me to lift out Sheila Shulman, Zichron Alevracha, who is one of our teachers and a teacher at Leah Beck College, would talk about the stream of righteousness that runs through the Tanakh, because there are really violent, awful parts in the Tanakh, but there's also teachings of empathy, of justice, of you name it, within it. And it's on us to kind of to lift that up and to talk about. And I think as well as it being, when we're talking and acting in politics within communities, not only is it about rooting it in values and text and finding theology and text that talks to this future that we want to see in this vision, it's also about relationships. And I think that's the greatest privilege of being clergy, is that when I was in community, all the time, preaching or teaching, I could look around the room and I would know pretty much the lives of those people. I would have had very deep conversations with the majority of them because I was in trusted, deep relationships with them. And one, that gives you a great responsibility, because actually you hold lives in some way and you can use that positively or negatively, and we're, you know, need to lead ethically. But also I think that what that means is that you can express opinions and have debate that is rooted in relationships and isn't about assumptions. And, you know, I'm sure, like you, when I got an email of complaint or a text message saying how angry they were, the first thing that I would do, and I'm sure you do too, is let's talk. I'll pick up the phone, come in and see me in the office. Let's talk it through. And often it would end in a really powerful conversation. Sometimes it wouldn't. And sometimes it'd be a red line of like, you know, this community might not be for you if this is so, you know, devastating for you, or it's not possible. But most of the time it was a real listening and being able to kind of talk to each other. And I think that's, and I just go back to that point of this line that we tread between holding diverse opinion and having underlying values. So we always say in our progressive spaces, Elu va Elu, which is a phrase that is taken from the Babylonian Talmud, Erevin 13b, which tells a story of Hillel and Shammai, who were the first kind of rabbis, proto-rabbis almost. And the text just says they were having a debate for 3 years. Fascinatingly, we have no idea what they were debating, but we could probably put in anything that we've spoken about today, you know, like New York mayoral elections, the rise of reform, you name it, it's in there. So they've had a debate for ages, and a voice from on high, a back call, divine voice comes down and says, Elu va Elu, both of these are the words of the living God. So both are valid, and you know, there's validity in every argument. So we use that phrase all the time to say there's diversity of opinion. But what we don't do is look at the end of that, which is where God goes, where God says, but the halakha, the Lord's going to follow Hillel. Right, like God makes a decision that actually there is a decision here, and I'm gonna and Hillel, we're gonna follow Hillel in this instance. But Shammai, your opinion is valid, and it has like divinity baked into it. Although, as we've been talking about, I think there are some opinions that aren't divine, that aren't being inspired by or led by God or divinity. I think any opinion that harms somebody else or dehumanizes them is not a divinity, is not holy. And I think that's very powerful to not lose the second part of that, which is to say there is still decisions to be made. Doesn't mean that we don't organize ourselves and we act, but we do it in relationship and through values.
And priorities that shift at different times. So I think for a good, like a number of years, my rabbinate and bringing a community together was very much about what's our voice in creating this fair and just society. That's prophetic Judaism. That's our calling. And actually, in the last number of years, that distinctive chosenness sense of what do we need as a Jewish community now? How do we prioritize what is right for us, and how we demonstrate our distinctiveness might actually be a shift. While the world is shifting around us, our leadership and our narrative needs to shift too. And so sometimes it's about what we raise up value-wise at any one moment, rather than, you know, shifting in what we believe in or choosing sides.
It's I love the Elu va Elu text and that sense of both. And the other text I often bring into these conversations is the Oven of Achnai story. Mm. And we teach this story about this, you know, the debate about the oven is actually irrelevant. But one rabbi is arguing one side on his own and bringing miracles to prove his point. And clearly God agrees with this one rabbi while the whole of the rest of the community of rabbis disagree, and demonstrate from the text, we rule with the majority. You can't prove things with divine intervention. But the part of the story that we often don't tell, and that I think is really core, is the next bit, which is that, you know, they allow the majority to rule, and they then absolutely destroy the life of the person who lost the debate, even though God was supporting that person. And that behavior results in natural tragedies and terrible things happening to the community, because how we treat the loser in a debate is also key. You know, the value of, as we hear with Elu va Elu, the value of both sides being heard and being recorded and being treated with dignity is part of the conversation. We're also told in that story that God has a great sense of humor, which I love, and that God laughs with us and at us and along with us. But we often don't tell the part of the story where they treat the loser so badly that they are punished, because that's not how debate is meant to work.
Yeah. And the Talmud itself is, you know, and I struggle with, this is probably a whole other episode of the Talmud, because it's such a kind of male conversation, and women are also often brought in as objects within it. But one of the most beautiful things about the Talmud is it records debate, it records difference of opinion. And these stories, and that's a really powerful one, the Oven of Achnai, particularly with how it ends, is that it's about how we're having that debate. And some of the stories within the Torah and within the Talmud, within the Tanakh more widely, are there as stories for us to understand the best and the worst of humanity within, of how we speak to each other and how we treat each other, and to hopefully offer up like a vision of a time that is better than this one that we're working towards. And I certainly feel, for me, like with my progressive Jewish background and upbringing, that that was kind of baked into me as a kid, that that's what my role is. And that's a burden, actually. It's something I kind of struggle with now, of like, is that too much for us, that kind of mission? Miriam, you always talk about like what the Jewish chosenness means is more mission than it is, you know, being a special people apart from everybody, which, you know, is helpful. But that mission of tikkun olam, that vacuous big term that means to heal the world, which we probably mean like politically and social action wise as well, that I always was brought up that that's my role in this world, to do that and to be part of it. And it feels really tricky when I feel that I can't do that. And it also feels like a massive burden of like, well, how can I do that, especially when things feel so dark? One thing I wanted to ask about this and get your thoughts on was, I've heard a lot quite recently that there's this like, it's the younger generation who are the one who are more political, who want to hear certain things in synagogues or see certain things happen. What do you make of that? Because I have some questions about it, of this generational divide. But what are your experiences with that?
Just that it's really complicated. Sometimes it's generational, sometimes it's not. And that creating a variety of spaces to hold all this difference is really important. And I think part of the challenge that we're facing is the role that social media plays in all this, which doesn't lend itself anymore. I think it potentially could have done, but doesn't seem to be lending itself to nuance and to helping people experience the conversation. But yeah, I don't know. I think the sense from one generation that the other view from me can't be given a platform. And that goes across generations. I think lots of people feel, whether they're from one generation or another, whatever it is I'm holding, that's right. And we mustn't platform this other thing in the synagogue or in the community, or, you know, Jews mustn't say this publicly. We can only say it privately. And it's a lot to negotiate.
I think our young adults, you know, have always been people who are able to take a strong view. It's the kind of luxury of that time in our life. I just wonder if there's now so many ways of expressing oneself and sharing one's views in such a much wider sense, that, you know, how would we have stamped our political opinion on the world when, as we were young adults, like we might have gone to a demonstration or a rally, or we might have held a view in a conversation in a pub, but there wasn't that constant being able to express not just our own views, but sharing other people's views that we agreed with. And therefore, it's not surprising that in this day and age, it feels like there's much more of a polarized view. And I don't think our young adults are taking a particular view, but they are definitely expressing a very strong view on how they see the world. But I don't think that's changed. I just think they're able to express themselves in multiple ways now.
And my sense is that it's not a generational divide. There might be a bit of an element to that, but there are many adults, grown-ups in communities that have really strong opinions that maybe don't allow for nuance in it, and adults who are deeply political in their very bones and beings and expect that in their synagogues and on the streets and in the neighbourhoods. My parents' generation were really political, really engaged with the existential threats of the time, brought up in the Cold War on the heels of the Shoah and World War II in some ways, because their parents had lived through it. They, you know, lived deeply political lives because of those experiences that shaped them. In some ways, I feel like I had the luxury of growing up in the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s, where it felt in my life relatively safe and secure. Like, we were living in a time of plenty in lots of ways. That's a very privileged thing to say, but in my little kind of little world, that was how it felt. And that feels like it's been disrupted really quite significantly and in various ways and various cracks. And in some ways, I feel like that kind of deer in the headlights, flight, a fight or freeze, you know, not, and sometimes I take different positions. Sometimes I just get frozen. I can't do anything. And I block all the news apps and I resort to my art, which I think is activism. But, you know, I do things that are not outward facing or active. And sometimes I feel like I have to do something and I do something. And then I think, is that actually helpful or not? But it's again, about going back to our, you know, Jewish values of like, you know, it's not on us to complete the work, but, you know, we can't also remove ourselves from it. It's about doing the small thing. And we have plenty of texts, I think, and experiences also that can kind of guide us. But I definitely feel very strongly that politics, you know, it's our job to help navigate the world that we're living in and to be able to have these nuanced conversations.
We've also looked at a couple of texts that do come down with a there's an answer. But so many of our ancient debates don't result in the kind of definitive and this person is right, which I hope really does gift us the ability to debate and listen and allow a space where there a difference of opinion can be the end of a conversation as well, but one where the conversation has to be had. I think the thing that scares me most is actually the people who won't engage in the conversation and won't listen or believe someone else stands for something to such an extent that they walk away from community because of it, rather than the people that lean in even further to say, I really have to hear and I really have to try and understand because I feel so differently from somebody who I've loved so dearly.
And actually, not just with community, but I'm seeing, particularly around Israel and Palestine, these conversations tearing apart families who, you know, don't speak for weeks or don't have Friday night dinner together anymore because the conversation is too painful and there's too much of a chasm between where people are sitting that they don't feel able to be together. And that feels like such a huge failure.
Yeah. It does feel like a failure. And I think there's also something for me in, we've not exactly unpacked this, have we? Like, what does it even mean to be political? Like, I do think that I've learned over, I've been ordained 8 years now, that being a female rabbi, but also being a progressive rabbi is itself political. Like, I did not choose to be a rabbi to be, well, I was a human rights lawyer, but I chose to be a rabbi not to make a point. Like, I chose because I thought communities are forces for good and my love for Judaism and serving divinity and all of that. But we know that being progressive comes with a certain layer of assumptions and hatred in some ways as well, here within Israel, in certain places within Israel. And maybe we might question like whether institutionally things are weighted against us in some way. So like, for example, the chief rabbi of the Orthodox communities in the UK, they don't recognize reform conversion, like our decisions. Reform weddings aren't recognized in Israel. There's this kind of gatekeeping, and certainly the comments which I've stopped myself reading on some of the Jewish papers around when something comes up with progressive clergy or communities, I feel like it's got worse recently, like that kind of real hatred within it, that this kind of intra fighting and stigma and discrimination. And for me, it's kind of like it's I'm picking up on that word failure, of like what it is, the failure of progressives maybe across the world, and also progressive Judaism or progressive Jewish thinking, is can we stand within who we are and proudly talk about what we stand for, and this really powerful message that I think we're talking to, which is to hold diversity, see humanity, and have really clear values. And one of those values being seeing the humanity in the other, and, you know, with the marginalized and all of that. Maybe it's for us to be able to kind of promote that and be celebrate it, rather than retreat away from the conversation, as Miriam was saying, or to resort to Elu v'Elu. Like, we all have multiplicity of views. Actually, no, we're progressive for a reason. Like, it means something. And obviously, that's a challenge to kind of work out what that means. But for me, it's about listening and relation, you know, organizing ourselves to have those conversations, to really listen to each other, to work out, you know.
I think it would make people much prouder to say, I belong. I belong to this because I've heard this view and this is my view, rather than our fear being, I can't say anything in case someone says, well, I can't belong to this because this is not my view.
Elu va elu, right? Both will happen if you do that, right? We will get both. And it's interesting, as you were saying all that, Robin, I was just clocking in myself that I'm really weary. I'm really tired from the constant battling around this.
And I wonder whether for me, it's like whether it's about doing politics differently. And I do think that's what communities can do, is that we're intergenerational spaces with diversity of opinions, and yet we have a common history and a common textual thing that actually politics shouldn't be exhausting. It should be empowering, right? Like, it should be something that can connect us, can make us feel prouder, stronger, all of those things. And actually at the moment, it's all broken, it feels like, because it's doing the opposite. It's making us think, well, I'm just going to retreat back to my home, you know, to do what I can do personally. And I actually can't make great change. Politics actually should be a force that says, yeah, together you can create great change. You've got power within you.
You know, I would have loved to have sat with Keir Starmer when he was making the decision about Andy Burnham and whether he could run in that local election.
I've got so much to say.
Because for me... For me, that was a great example of a terrified leader. A good, strong leader wants great, popular people around them. You're great at your job. I'm great at mine. Let's do this together. Makes for a much stronger piece of work than someone that says, oh, but you're really popular and you're really good, so let me keep you away in case that makes me less good or less popular. And fascinating, that piece of like, what's good for me is not necessarily what's good for us, and what we're all meant to be working towards. It was for me a really bare, kind of very vulnerable moment of, you've really just shown your hands in a timid, scared leader way, not in a really strong, I'm doing what's best for everybody way, which, I was shocked he didn't have better people around him to help him make a better decision.
Yeah. And that's, again, that's like another piece of evidence to my thing of saying politics feels broken at the moment, because actually you want dissent. You want people like around your board at synagogue council who have different opinions. You don't want echo chambers. You want that challenge because you get stronger through it. And actually, again, if we're about unity and it's about loyalty and you don't want people who you might perceive as a threat and you see things through that thing, that's a worry. Like, actually, I want to know that like the government is full of people who have different opinions but are able to meet around a shared goal. So maybe from our lips to, what do you say? I always forget.
I don't know.
Seems unlikely.
Yeah, anyway, well, there we go. We've painted quite a vision today. I feel kind of empowered, but also holding some of the wariness and weariness that Debbie mentioned as well, because these things are tricky. It's not, I say this every episode, I can talk the good talk, but I'm not sure I walk the good walk, because it is complex and it's hard, this stuff. But I think, again, speaking about it has to be the first thing. And with that in mind, we want to keep talking together and with everyone who listens as well. Unlike Miriam and Debbie, I know people are listening and don't forget about it. And I listen back to the podcast. So I'm also a listener as well as a podcaster. And we just love hearing from you. We always share the messages that we receive and the comments that people make, because it really helps us know that what we're doing is in some ways like generative and meeting you where you're at as well. So yeah, keep messaging us, letting us know which conversations you felt fully invested in. Be in touch and spread the word, as they say. Our Insta handle is @rabbiting_on_podcast. And maybe share something that you're reflecting on, something that you're holding. Keep posting, rate it, share it with your friends and colleagues, so we can keep moving forward within it. We've got lots more really interesting conversations to be had in this series. Thank you both so much, and looking forward to our next episode.
Nice to chat.
See you soon.
Bye. Rabbiting on.